It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. This week, we are here to help you celebrate, no matter what you're celebrating. The woman who started the whole Mediterranean craze, Paula Wolford, is bringing us the latest, Slow Mediterranean, with dynamite recipes you have to do ahead. The Stearns have found the perfect country inn to escape to in Dorset, Vermont. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks champagne's best-kept secret, small producers delivering big buys. Tiny Tim takes the heat for one cook's goose. Then it's doing your own akvavit with Scandinavian Uber chef Andreas Wiedstadt. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, this week we are doing holiday spin, angling the hectic and mind-numbing into the leisurely and imaginative. Paula Wolford brings us slow Mediterranean cooking, the fabulous food that you have to do ahead. Wine maverick Josh Wesson solves the wine lover's gift dilemma with champagne's best-kept secrets. Writer David Leet gives Tiny Tim a bad rap when he takes on a roast goose. Then it's the Scandinavian tradition of akvavit with Oslo Food Authority Andreas Vidstad. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now that number's 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, as you probably know, Jane and I love a restaurant that has a mascot. We found, I think, what is our favorite mascot of all times at the Dorset Inn in Dorset, Vermont. The mascot is a basset hound named Fergie, who is approximately 150 years old and can barely walk. She greets you at the door, or if she's awake, she greets you at the door. If not, you just see her sleeping in a chair. But anyway, once you get beyond Fergie, you go into the dining room of the Dorset Inn, which is, in fact, Vermont's oldest inn, and you have a spectacularly good breakfast, lunch, or dinner 7 days a week.
So you just stay in the same place and you just let him bring him on, and Fergie snores in the chair nearby.
That's the idea. The person who runs the dining room and is, in fact, owner of the inn is a woman named Sissy Hicks. She's run the place for 20 years. She grew up in Pennsylvania, and she cooks it's Vermont country inn comfort food. Her specialty, believe it or not, and I know some people are not going to appreciate this as much as Jane or I do, her specialty is liver and onions.
Oh, but that can be such a good dish.
It's nowhere better.
It was tender as foie gras. It was sweet with onions and thickly cut slices of bacon. It was probably the best liver and onions I have ever had, and I am a liver and onion aficionado.
Now, I'm picturing that this place, if you're saying it's the oldest inn, goes back to about the 1700s. Is it really pretty?
It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's been revamped. I mean, it's not smelly and old. It's beautiful and clean and old.
So glad.
It's a big white building on the town square in Dorset, which itself is a kind of picture-perfect Vermont town. I mean, just a beautiful, beautiful little community in Vermont. The inn is a great big white structure on the square. Inside there are fireplaces. We've never stayed there, but I would imagine the rooms are just cozy and comfortable the way you want them to be. And the meals there are just what you want in a Vermont country inn.
We ate three meals a day there, and they had probably the best buttermilk pancakes with brilliant blueberries in them and crunchy raised waffles, you know, the old style, not the big Belgian waffle,
right,
but yeast raised, you know, small tread waffles with real Vermont maple syrup. And Fergie, the basset hound, stared at us from the door of the dining room. And next to Fergie, there was, I think, another dog who was probably 175 years old. It was a black lab with a totally gray face. And these, you know, these four eyes, you know, looking at us plaintively. I don't know if they were allowed in the dining room per se, but they certainly wanted to come in.
What they really wanted was a piece of waffle.
They did.
What kind of things do they do for dinner?
My favorite thing, in addition to the liver and onions, is turkey croquettes. And these are like real old-fashioned, you know, turkey croquettes made from white meat and dark meat, very, very moist with a crisp, crunchy outside, really good kind of savory gravy with, of course, mashed potatoes and real homemade succotash on the side. I forgot how much I like really good, creamy, bacon-flavored succotash, and they make it here to go on the side of dinner.
They also, for dessert, have the most incredible puddings. Puddings are a real Vermont thing, and grape nut pudding and rice pudding made from scratch, absolutely delicious. I mean, perfect, perfect comfort food, especially if you go up in the winter during snow season. It is just a delight to stay there.
What a great place for the holidays.
It's really my favorite new place.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn.
Happy holidays, Lynn.
And to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Icy finger waves, ski trails down the mountainside.
I wonder what they were drinking. Well, the Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food, which, by the way, is not a bad gift idea for the road warriors out there. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our weekly newsletter. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our humble attempt to make weeknight cooking a little easier. You get a recipe every week, my notes on key ingredients, and ideas for what to look for in the market. And best of all, it's free. So register for it online at splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is my kind of maverick. He's a wine expert who left the pack behind a long time ago. Josh believes good wine can be had for little money, and he's always coming up with new ideas of what to try. Hey, Josh, it's good to have you back.
Oh, I can't believe you caught me. I'm driving around doing my holiday shopping, and I'm thinking about wine, too, but now I'm looking for a digital camera for my girlfriend.
You know, you are not able to get away from us, no way, no how. You realize this.
You hunt me down like the wine dog that I am.
I know we normally talk kind of very low end on the cost scale, but it's the holidays, and I am really crazy for champagne, and I'm ready to spend a little more than usual. So I want to know, what do you think I should hunt down?
Well, champagne happens to be one of my absolute favorite wines. I drink it all year long, but I think about it more often than any other time at this time of year. And the watchword this year in champagne is grower champagne, small houses, people who actually grew the grapes and made the wine, because that's quite unusual for champagne, unlike the rest of the wine world.
I didn't realize that. You mean most champagnes are made by people who buy grapes from other people?
Yeah. In fact, the vast majority of the champagnes that we're used to seeing, whether it's Moët et Chandon or Roederer, are made by large producers who are buying grapes. They have to buy grapes because they couldn't own enough vineyards in Champagne to cover the vast output. But there are these growers that constitute this almost new wave of winemaking there. And even though they're small in their percentage, they only represent about 2% of the total production in Champagne, they are capturing people's attention. They certainly captured my palate because they're made with soul. They're made from a place. They taste like a human being injected some of their vibrance and vitality into the wine in a way that a mass-produced champagne never could.
Huh. So can you name some names for us?
Yeah, they're probably names that people who are listening have never heard of before, because I hadn't heard of them until quite recently.
Uh-huh.
And these are people who own 5 acres, 7 acres, 10 acres of land, and usually their families help them pick the grapes, and it's a family affair. These are made by people in the truest sense of the term.
Uh-huh.
And one of my favorites is made by R. Dumont, D-U-M-O-N-T. It's a simple Brut, non-vintage, but there's nothing simple about the way the wine tastes. It has depth and complexity. It almost tastes like a white Burgundy that has bubbles in it. I mean, it's that deep in its flavor.
Well, you're singing my song. I love white Burgundies. They're my favorite splurge wine. What does this run in cost?
it's not that expensive because none of these, you know, small growers have any budgets for advertising or marketing. So every dollar that you spend comes back in terms of the flavor. It's about $27 to $30, and it's absolutely my go-to champagne when I'm serving at parties around the holidays.
Okay.
I've got a couple of others too.
Okay.
When I want to kick it up, you know, a bubble or two, there's a little producer. I mean, this guy owns, I think, 5 acres of land in the southern part of Champagne, and he's growing only Chardonnay, so he's making a Blanc de Blanc. And his name is José Michel, sort of half French, half Spanish,
half Spanish.
All love machine. And his 1998 sells for about $35 a bottle, but it is just the most elegant gossamer cloud of bubbles that I've come across in a very long time. And it's lighter than the Dumont, but it is just, it's truly like drinking stars, if I can, you know, beat that cliched term into something that's true. It's just magnificent wine.
So, Josh, what if I want to go for a really big splurge?
Well, you don't have to spend as much as you would on a Dom Perignon or a Cristal. They're really great news, especially at holiday time, with these little grower champagnes, is their very best wines cost about half as much as the big boys' great wines. And I think they're twice as good. So you get tremendous value for your money, even if you're spending $40 to $50 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite producer right now is Chartons Taillet. And it's spelled Chartogne with a hyphen, Taillet. They're in a little town of Mercy where everyone is insanely happy because they're always drinking champagne. Who wouldn't be? And this wine is deep and rich and complex, and adjectives flip by. And, you know, it's one of those champagnes. A lot of champagne you'll taste and you say, that's nice, okay, next. But this stuff, you never forget it. You will remember what this wine tastes like 5 years from now, 5 holidays from now. It's that good. It's that deep. It's that soulful. I want some now.
Oh, Josh, thank you. And you have a great holiday.
Happy holidays to you, too.
Wine Authority Joshua Wesson is creator and co-owner of Best Sellers Wine Shops. Now, you can get Josh's champagne picks on the website, splendidtable.org. So, assuming you have something bubbly to drink, what do you serve with it? Of course, there's my favorite, Marilyn Monroe's advice. Now, in The Seven-Year Itch, her character, the girl, said, champagne and potato chips is simply elegant. And so is popcorn, by the way. Anything salty and crunchy is great with fizzy wines. So is smoked seafood, spicy salami, raw carrots, and creamy stuff, like sour cream with some onion and basil. And yes, this is nudging up to that classic French onion dip, okay? Which, by the way, tastes very good with champagne. Now, if you've got a foodie on your list with a zany streak, you could give them a container of creme fraiche, rich man's sour cream, and a box of imported onion soup mix. Coming up, the new slow Mediterranean cooking with Paula Wolfert, cooking your own goose, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. I wish I had a list of how many people in the food business want to be Paula Wolfert when they grow up. Paula is the consummate food authority. She's always going to the source. Research is her middle name. Now, all of the Mediterranean is her beat, and no one has brought its glories to life the way Paula does. Her recipes sing. Now, her latest book is ideal for right now. It's called The Slow Mediterranean Kitchen, Recipes for Passionate Cooks. Paula, good to have you back.
I'm delighted, and thank you for those very kind words.
Well, it's been a long time since we have talked, and you've
right.
been working with this whole idea of slow cooking.
Which is why it's taken me some time.
Well, yeah, I guess that makes sense. But what I'm thinking about is that, you know, right now we're in a world of fast cooking. Everybody's doing these flash sautés, and, you know, why are you being contrary, woman?
I'm not being contrary. I'm being true. I'm being true to the food of the Mediterranean. Mediterranean food is slow. And the reason it's slow is that the people, it's part of the old ways of life. You take your time and you get the food on the table, but you care about the food. You care about what you're doing. Now, that doesn't mean that you still can't go to work, feed the kids, clean the house, because slow does not require you to be in the kitchen. It just means you need to know you're going to eat tomorrow. I mean, you just have to prepare some things a day in advance, but it just benefits from slow. I mean, do you know what I mean by slow?
Well, why don't you explain it?
Well, there's slow braising, there's slow marinating, there's slow frying, slow grilling, slow mm-hmm. baking, but there's even the zen of slow, stale bread.
Well, can you give us some examples of the kinds of dishes? Like, for instance, I'm thinking about fish, because most people don't think about slow cooking fish.
I know, it does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? But in fact, lots of Mediterranean dishes use the concept of slow-fried fish, fish slow-poached in olive oil, fish baked slowly in clay, sun-dried fish, even oven-steamed fish, fish marinated and preserved in olive oil. You can cook mussels the day before in a lot of wonderful aromatics and let it mellow overnight. There are so many ways that the Mediterraneans have found to cook fish for its optimum pleasure in the slow lane.
What about dishes for people who don't eat meat, vegetarian?
Well, I'm a great lover of vegetables, and I put together a little quartet of things that you could put on the holiday table. I love to have something like a potato and fennel gratin, where the fennel and the potatoes are sliced paper thin and left to cook very, very slowly in the oven in an earthenware pan so that they almost blend, meld, and then there's sort of a little cheese thing that's put on top.
Uh-huh.
Then there's leeks simmered in olive oil, and the leeks are cooked with a little bit of rice and carrots, but this is a Turkish dish, so it's served lukewarm, and it can be done the day before, and it's only better. There's a very interesting North African dish of artichokes and oranges, which is served cool. The artichokes are cooked first, then the juice of the orange is allowed to glaze in a fry pan with a little bit of sugar, and then the artichokes and the oranges are glazed in it so they shine, and then fresh mint is sort of put on top. It's a wonderful combination if you would just wait till tomorrow to eat it. And then there's glazed carrots and olives. This is a dish from the 19th century. You can do it in a crock pot if you want. You can do it in a very heavy pan. You cook the carrots in their own moisture with a little piece of parchment paper right over the carrots. They cook so slowly over such low heat that the moisture within the carrots cooks the carrots. That way the carrots taste. You've never tasted carrots that have cooked in their own moisture. It is stereophonic carrots. Then you saute them a little bit in either butter or oil with a few green olives and a little tiny bit of creme fraiche and herbs. And it's the most delicious vegetable dish. So you have a symphony on the table of leeks, artichokes, oranges, carrots, and a little green and white. It's a very pretty, pretty festive holiday platter of vegetables.
What would we have if we wanted meat? What would we have as part of the
well,
meal?
I'm a big fan of my slow-roasted chicken stuffed with sausage and porcini. It's a dish from Bordeaux from one of my favorite chefs. His name is Ziradakis, and it's a roasted chicken that had been rubbed with duck fat, which really made it taste delicious. But you don't have to. If you don't have the duck fat in the house, don't worry. You can do it with a little butter or oil. Mm-hmm. And the sausage and porcini, or you can use dried porcini, of course, because that's what I used, filling you make the day before. So it has a chance to really blend. And then when you put that inside the chicken, it flavors the chicken beautifully. And I roast my chickens upside down. I find that the juices, when they run backwards, really keep the breast quite moist.
Oh, Paula, we're going to have a ball digging into this menu. Thank you, and have a great holiday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, and you too.
Paula Wolfert is author of The Slow Mediterranean Kitchen. You can get her recipes for glazed carrots with green olives and leeks in olive oil on the website splendidtable.org. Traditions die hard this time of year. People are inspired by picture-perfect photos of friends, family, and food that are, well, frankly, usually pretty hard to obtain. That said, there are moments of pure serendipity, inspiration that pops up from unusual places. Take this story of writer David Leet and a goose.
I've been a haunted man for 13 years, and I put the blame squarely on Tiny Tim's crooked little shoulders. It was December 1990, and I had just finished rereading A Christmas Carol. Inspired by Tiny's exultant prayer, "God bless us, everyone," I decided that I, too, would have a proper Christmas dinner. The next day, I marched into my local butcher shop in Brooklyn and ordered a goose. Luigi, a short, rotund man who had a stand on a milk crate to talk to his customers, leaned over the meat case and cocked an eyebrow. "Have you ever made a goose before?" "Please, plenty of times," I replied, even though the only experience I had cooking fowl was microwaving Swanson turkey dinners. On Christmas Day, I awoke early to prepare the goose. To ensure a moist bird, I tucked pats of butter under its skin, then slid it into the oven. After several hours, I checked to see if the magic thermometer had popped up, signaling the goose was done. But I couldn't find one. Anywhere. I yanked the goose out of the oven, sloshing a tsunami of melted fat on the floor. I turned the bird over and over, looking for that confounded popper. Just then, the doorbell rang. I returned the goose to the oven and hoped for the best. As my five guests sipped Diet Coke and nibbled from an artfully arranged platter of Doritos and Lipton onion dip, I excused myself and ran back into the kitchen. I returned, ushering everyone to their seats. I placed the goose on the table and began carving. But every time I sliced, I hit bone. No matter what angle I tried, the knife simply slid off. "So much for Christmas is coming, the goose is getting fat," I tried to joke, as I strip-mined the bird for meat with a fork. Eventually, I gave up and divided the two legs among six plates. My guests looked down at their pitifully small portions and smiled weakly. After everyone left, I cleaned up. Furious, I grabbed the platter and flipped the goose into the trash. And there, staring up at me, were two perfectly plump breasts. In my frantic search for the magic thermometer, I had turned the goose upside down and later carved from its scrawny, meatless back. In the intervening years, I'm happy to report that I have become a whiz at roasting, except goose. Last week, while visiting Danny Pring, a Connecticut neighbor, I recounted my tale. "And you haven't made a Christmas goose since?" she bellowed. An expat from England who's blessed with an alto's lungs and cursed with a hearing problem, Danny clocks in at a decibel level just below that of a Boeing 747. "Nope," I said. "Well, next weekend we're marching into your kitchen and I'm going to show you how it's done properly," she announced. The day of our lesson, Danny burst into my kitchen with her arms filled with bottles, scraps of papers, herbs, and two roasting pans. "Look," she said, waving a carving fork that would do the Marquis de Sade proud. "For inflicting the jabs, you have to prick the goose all over to drain the fat," she added. I took the bird from the refrigerator, and Danny trundled over, cooing, "My, that is a proper Christmas goose, David." She took it from me, then she stood as if in a trance. "Danny, what's wrong?" I asked. She put her fingers to her lips, lowered her head, then said softly, well, softly for Danny, "Now's the time to think of all the people who have ever borne a grudge against you, and you go for it." With that, she descended upon the bird with her carving fork. To judge from the ferocity of her stabs and the contentment on her face, my guess was she was fantasizing about Tony Blair. When she was done, she leaned against the counter and trumpeted, "Boy, was that cathartic!" She looked like a boxer who had just won a prize fight. "So what's next?" I asked. She slipped the bird in the oven. "Well, you sit here and mind Goosey, and I'll be back in a couple of hours." "What? Why?" I asked. She looked at me as if I were daft. "I'm knackered," she said. And with that, she tromped out the back door. "The directions are on the table," she barked from her car. Without Danny there to guide me, I was immediately haunted by the goose of Christmas past. I riffled through her scraps of paper. One read that the bird needed to be turned 3 times. "Turned," I said aloud. Another read, "Drain the fat." But when? Visions of snickering guests danced in my head. Still, I knew that if I didn't face this bete noir head-on, I'd probably develop a severe tic every time I was served foie gras. So I made some quick calculations and estimated when to turn the goose and poured off fat several times, lest there be another flood. When I removed the goose, it was nothing like the catastrophe I had wrought in my youth. It was a beautiful mahogany color with a crackly, crispy crust. One last hurdle, though, before I could be free of my demons. I poked the top of the bird. Yes, just as I thought. It was a lovely, juicy breast. 20 minutes later, Danny muscled through the door. When she saw the goose, her face clouded over. She leaned in close, inspecting. She tilted the bird one way, then the other. Finally, she said, "Brilliant, David!" I beamed. She transferred the bird to a platter and held it aloft. "Behold the goose!" she crowed. Then she thrust her chin toward the dining room. "Now, good God, let's eat!" Tiny Tim himself couldn't have said it better.
Food Authority David Leet writes for national publications and is the creator of leetsculinaria.com. Now, for those of you who are considering a Christmas goose, I've got a great way to do it. You stuff it with a ton of garlic and some apples. You rub it with seasoning and a little vinegar. You roast it slow, and you make a pan sauce with Madeira. The garlic kind of gently permeates the meat, and it is luscious. Now, you can get the recipe for garlic roast goose on the website, splendidtable.org. Tis the time of year for giving and serving great potables. ciders, beers, wines, and don't forget about akvavit. Now, to get to the heart of the matter, we are talking to Scandinavian Food Authority Andreas Widstad. He is the host of PBS's New Scandinavian Cooking and author of Kitchen of Light. Andreas comes to us from Oslo. Andreas, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
I think we need a definition before we go any further. Can you explain to us what akvavit actually is?
Well, I could go back to the Latin and say it's the water of life. No, akvavit is the Scandinavian liquor. It's spiced liquor. It's most of the time you have potato vodka. You can use any kind of unflavored alcohol. And it's seasoned with different spices. Caraway is almost always there. Cumin, fennel seeds, anise seed. And then you can use a lot of variations. You can use a bit of cinnamon or some cardamom. But basically it is flavored and spiced liquor. But it can be made in 1,000 different ways.
Now, how do you use it?
Well, one way is, of course, to drink it. And the Scandinavians have had a long, long tradition of drinking and drinking perhaps too much of it. I mean, there was a period of time when lumbermen were sent out into the forest with a bottle of akvavit because it was nice. It wouldn't freeze, you know, in the
yes.
cold weather. And of course, you can also use it in cooking. I use it frequently in cooking. If I want that spiced flavor to a sauce or if I want to marinate, I use it both as a medium for marinating, which alcohol is very good,
right.
But also it has a lot of flavor of its own. And I have a recipe that I like a lot for pork tenderloin, which is flambéed in akvavit.
So to make it ourselves, we'd combine the spices and put it into vodka and let it sit for a period of time?
Yeah. And I think one of the great things about that is if you have a bottle of vodka and you add the spices and you every evening I just turn it around to mix it and I take a small taste. Is it just right? Is it strong enough? The flavor. And that's a really nice ritual as well.
Hey, Andreas, thank you.
Thank you.
Andreas Widstad is author of Kitchen of Light. You can get his recipe for mock akvavit on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Well, I have to confess, this really isn't trivia, but it comes out of a great email. The question is, what is the silliest instruction found on a food package this year? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com www.cbs.ca/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's kind of trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the silliest instruction found on a food package this past year? This, by the way, was inspired by an email from Professor Ken Albala. Well, our Goose Egg Award goes to Frito's Corn Chips for their package, which stated, and I quote, "You could be a winner. No purchase necessary. Details inside." Second prize is awarded to Tesco Markets in England for the warning that's printed on the bottom of their tiramisu dessert, which says, "Do not turn upside down." And third prize goes to American Airlines for putting this on their snack nut packages. I quote, "Instructions, colon, open package, eat nuts." The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Brooke calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. So, Brooke, tell me, are you guys completely snowed in there?
Well, it's about 6 to 8 inches deep, and it's below zero right now.
Oh, so. that for you guys is just normal, right? It's spring.
Yeah, it's pretty typical.
So, did you have a question?
I did. I was calling because I was wondering, what do you do with a pomegranate besides peel it and eat the seeds?
Oh, boy. Okay. First of all, it always reminds me of little rubies. Yeah. And you can sprinkle those seeds into salads and over vegetables.
Okay.
Yeah, they're really nice. The other thing you can do is pierce the pomegranate and squeeze the you-know-what out of it to get the juice. And the juice is delicious. And if you're doing like a quick saute of a piece of fish or a piece of meat, you know, just for a weeknight supper kind of thing, after you take the food that's done out of the pan, throw in the pomegranate juice and just boil it down. You could have a little garlic in there if you wanted until it's syrupy. And it's sweet and tart and it has a delicious flavor. And you drizzle that over a piece of chicken breast. Oh, it's out of this world, just out of this world. The other thing that you can do with it is use that juice and make a sorbet. You need a lot of pomegranates to get there, but you would just sweeten it to taste and you'd throw it into an ice cream machine or you'd throw it in the freezer in a shallow dish and let it freeze, almost freeze, and then you stir it with a fork and then it almost freezes again and you stir it again. You do that about 3 times and then you stir it again until it's really ragged and that becomes, instead of a sorbet, a granita. And it's fabulous to serve as a dessert.
Oh, that sounds really delicious.
Yeah. So, and it's just, I don't like to fool too much with it beyond that because the flavor is so delicious on its own, as you know, that you don't want to mess around with it too much. And by the way, those seeds freeze beautifully.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. So you can keep them through the year.
Okay, because they don't get them all year round.
No, this is the time. This is the time of year to cash in.
Okay.
It really is.
And when you're buying a pomegranate, we usually just have like a little box at the supermarket with two in it, but I went to the store the other day and there's a giant display of them. When you buy one, should you look for one that's firm or are there a few that were soft?
You should always have, they always should be firm. They should be heavy for their size in your hand. There should be no sign of rotting or any moist areas. And I always sniff the top, you know, that sort of opens up, not the stem end, but the blossom end of it. If there's any kind of unpleasant smell, I don't buy it. Because sometimes they, you know, if they've been kept around for a very long time, they're rotten. So heavy for its size, a nice sort of gleam to the skin, and no mushy or soft areas.
All right.
And store them. You can keep them in the fridge if you want. But remember, once you get those seeds, you can freeze.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'd be great. And they make great decoration. I just like to cut them in half and look at them on a plate.
Yeah, they're really pretty.
And that's what I do in my spare time. Hey, you take care.
Yeah, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Give us a call, guys. 800-537-5252. We have Alice calling from San Antonio, Texas. So, Alice, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, our family just loves your show.
Thank
you. And we were hoping you could help us with the problem we have every year about this time. I end up spending a small fortune on candied chestnuts because my children and I just adore them. And but they're quite spendy.
Oh, yes, they sure are.
Yeah, and so I was thinking it would be fun to make them ourselves with the children, but I can't find a recipe for it.
One of the things about this, and I've got a vague idea, I've never done this, but I've got an idea of how to do it. But one of the things is that this has always been much more the candy maker's art than generally done at home. Now, as soon as I say that, you know there's going to be thousands of exceptions. This is the basic idea of how you would do candy chestnuts. You start out with those chestnuts that are imported from Europe because we had a blight in this country and we don't have any more. And you want to buy ones that look firm and that have a bit of a glow to them. In so many words, they look fresh.
Right.
And what you want to do is make a cross on the flat side of the chestnut, cut into it, and you want to soak it. And you want to soak it for maybe 2 days. Okay, because you want to get that shell off. And as soon as you think that you can remove the shell with some ease, you take the shell off, but you continue soaking because you want about 48 hours. Do it in the refrigerator because you don't want it rotting. And then what you do is you get rid of those skins. There's a under the shell, there's a brown skin, which you're probably familiar with. That will be loosened from the soaking. Then you put together a sugar syrup, which is usually equal parts of sugar and water, with a couple of vanilla beans. And that's the syrup that you that ends up permeating them. So what you would do is you'd bring that, you'd boil that until it's clear, and then you'd drop in the chestnuts, okay, and you'd simmer them for about 10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
Then you drain them. You pull them out of that sugar syrup, okay? You cool them down. You cool down the syrup, and then you let them sit in that syrup overnight in a cool place. Then you boil them for another 5 minutes and you pull, you separate each part, you let it cool, you put it together, you let it go for another 5 minutes simmering. You do that for 3 days.
Oh my goodness.
And then at the very end, when you still have some syrup left, you line up the chestnuts, put them on a rack over a baking pan, drizzle the syrup over them, and put them in a very low oven for a couple of hours. Now, they're not going to necessarily be quite as gorgeous as the ones that you buy. They may be a little stickier and drippier, but you will have successfully permeated them with sugar syrup, and that's the whole idea.
Okay.
Hey.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. You can call us 800-537-5252. We've got Jim calling from St. Louis. Hey, Jim, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to call and talk to the Sage of Spices.
I think she went out for coffee, but I'll fill in.
Well, I do most of the cooking in my house, and when I cook with something, I'd like to, I want to understand what it is and what all I can do with it.
Right.
And I love old cookbooks, and in all these old cookbooks, I always see it, allspice for this and allspice for that. And so I went and bought some allspice. And it smells like cloves, but if it was cloves, I think they'd call it cloves. And I was wondering, what exactly is allspice and what can I do with it?
Oh, you've hit a nerve. You've hit a nerve. Like you, I love old cookbooks and I love food history. And allspice is one of the herbs or one of the spices that really played a trick on Columbus when he first came to the Americas, because, you know, he was looking for essentially the path to get to the Spice Islands, where all the expensive spices came from.
Yeah, but so he could get rich.
Yeah, exactly. And instead, he landed in the Caribbean. Allspice grows in the Caribbean on an evergreen tree. And if you were to see it on the tree, it looks like little clusters of berries that look a lot like peppercorns, if you've ever seen peppercorns on a tree.
Sure.
Now, what happened was they looked at this berry and they dried it, and it had sort of a spicy taste, and they took it back to Europe. And then they realized, no, this was something completely different. And the, and it has two names. In English, it's called allspice. But for instance, in France, it is called, if you translate the name of it, it's called Jamaica pepper.
Huh.
Because of that resemblance to the peppercorn. You know,
they're,
they had high hopes that they were going to make a fortune. Because back in those days, if you had a lot of peppercorns, you made a fortune. Oh. But essentially, the reason it's called allspice is that it tastes, you're dead right, it tastes like cloves with a hint of cinnamon and nutmeg. And people learned to love it because it really did combine those three flavors. And it meant that you didn't have to have all those other spices. Now, have you tried playing around with it? Have you used it at all?
No, I actually haven't used it.
Okay. One thing that's wonderful, and I use it this way, I mix allspice and chili powder, and I rub that, I toss that with a bit of olive oil for roasting root vegetables, like sweet potatoes and rutabaga together with lots of onion and garlic.
Oh,
and you, yeah, salt and pepper, allspice, a little bit of chili powder, and then you put that in a 400-degree oven in a shallow pan, you are in heaven. Think of the allspice as something that you would use like black pepper.
Okay, well, I'll try that.
Okay, Jim. Hey, you take care.
Oh, you too.
Goodbye.
I think you are this age.
Hey, thank you. Every once in a while, a moment comes. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Jerry on the line. Jerry's calling from Louisville, Kentucky, and it's Louisville, right, Jerry? Not Louisville.
Either way you want to go. I pronounce it Louisville, and I'm a native, and a lot of people pronounce it Louisville. So you're doing fine.
I feel vindicated. Did you have a question?
Yes, I did, Lynn. My question concerns preparation of either bison meat or buffalo meat. It's my understanding that buffalo meat is lower in fat than beef and lower in cholesterol than chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for alternatives to those types of foods.
Well, you've made a good choice because the flavor can be incredible. Essentially, the way it works with bison or buffalo, which I never am sure, but I think they're the same thing, is that whatever you can do with beef, you can do with bison or buffalo. In so many words, you know, you can do stews, steaks, roasts, etc. But, and what I've learned about it is I learned from a man named Sam Arnold, who has the Fort restaurant in Denver, Colorado. And he, by the way, he did a cookbook called The Fort Cookbook, where he talks a lot about buffalo. This guy has been serving buffalo since the 1970s. And he does steaks that you could swear you are eating a prime aged piece of beef. The key, though, is because it's low in fat, it has great flavor. But because it's low in fat, you want to generally, if you're using a tender cut, like the hump or a rib roast or a steak, and believe it or not, the hump is pretty tender, is you want to cook it slow and you want to keep it a bit on the medium rare to rare side. Because if you cook it, you know, until it's very well done, it really tastes like shoe leather.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, let's say you've got you're doing a holiday number or a party number and you want a rib roast of buffalo. You would start it out at about 500 degrees for 15 or 20 minutes just to get it rolling. And then you turn the heat down to 250. And you'd roast it maybe for medium rare, maybe 17 to 18 minutes per pound.
Okay.
If you're doing a steak, try to get cuts that are a bit on the thick side, okay? And then sear them on the outside so you get them browned. You could even rub them with a little olive oil to help that browning.
Okay.
Which, again, is very low in cholesterol. You don't have to worry about that.
Great.
And then cook them over low heat. Cook them slow. And they'll be tender, and they'll be juicy, and they'll be delicious. Now, if you're doing a stew, you know, with a chewier part of the meat, or you're doing burgers, that's a different deal. You know, with a stew, you'd cook it as you would a beef stew. But just remember, when you want to serve something like a steak or a roast, low and slow.
Okay.
And keep it more on the pink side.
Great.
And you are going to love it. This is not going to feel like a sacrifice.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. You take care.
You too.
Bye, Jerry.
Bye.
Well, you know, right now, the odds are pretty high that you are going to get some sort of horrendous stain on your very best clothes or the best tablecloth because it's the holidays. Well, we have somebody who can help you out. His name is Jerry Posnack, and he works with Cameo Cleaners of Gramercy Park in New York City. Now, he is an expert on getting out food stains. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, I know you are a dry cleaner, but you've also got some culinary background from what I understand. Is that right?
That is correct. About 6 or 7 years ago, finished up a certificate program at the French Culinary Institute here in New York City.
So this sort of gives you a deeper understanding of what you're dealing with in terms of stains, or did you do this because you love to cook?
Well, I love to cook, but after I finished the program, I realized that I can definitely use the knowledge that I received at the French Culinary Institute to further the kind of dry cleaning, especially since we deal with a higher-end clientele here at the shop.
Uh-huh. I love specialists. Well, okay. I want to know, what is the most common stain that you see?
Believe it or not, the most common thing that we get over the counter is usually salad oil or salad dressings, balsamic vinaigrette,
uh-huh.
What I see most of.
So how do you treat that particular one? Because that's pretty common at our house, too.
Well, on a dry cleaning standpoint, the oil component is something that dissolves instantaneously in dry cleaning fluid, so that's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sugar component in the balsamic vinegar is generally removable by what we would call wet side chemistry, or something which is a water-based stain remover.
Is there anything we can do before we bring you the items that would help the process?
The best thing is to leave the stain alone. to be honest, I mean, well-meaning wait staff in restaurants putting club soda or salt on stains just sometimes will actually create a larger problem for me as a dry cleaner. I would prefer my clients to, and this is the advice that I give my clients all the time, is to leave it alone, blot it, don't rub, never rub on a stain because rubbing will actually may cause chafing of the fabric, which is not reversible. So just blot it, leave it alone.
Okay. So when I get that big blob of salad dressing on the front of the silk blouse, just let it sit.
Well, leave it alone because, you know, oil and water won't mix. So if you add water to an oil-based stain, you're really not going to remove it. You may make it worse, especially if the silk top that you're wearing is sensitive to water. You may leave a water ring. You may actually cause colors to bleed if it's, say, it's a multicolored silk top.
Mm-hmm.
So you're better off leaving it alone.
Well, I have to tell you, Jerry, I wish you did house calls.
Well, in fact, many of our clients will send us garments and household items from across the country. In fact, I have an interesting story of a client who once was on a honeymoon in Tuscany and spilled red wine on a white linen top, and she sent it to me Federal Express from Tuscany so that I can make sure that blouse was right for her when she got back from her honeymoon.
Well, if you see a big package coming in from Minnesota, you'll know who it's from. Thanks a lot.
I'll take good care of it for you.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome.
Jerry Posnack is the owner of Cameo Cleaners in New York City. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And from all of us here at the Splendid Table to you and yours, have a fine holiday. And until next time, let me leave you with this toast. Dance as if no one is watching. Sing as though no one is listening. And live every day as though it's your last. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great holiday and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
RI, Public Radio International.